Hello, everybody out there, wherever you might be watching or listening. This is David Rovics with another episode of Fifth Estate Live, a broadcast produced by longtime Fifth Estate collective member, editorial collective. That's the word I'm looking for. Editorial collective member Peter Werby in Detroit, Michigan, comes to you every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, and then on Wednesdays and Fridays, on most Wednesdays and Fridays, I'm also interviewing people on my self-produced Discussions with David show, which goes out on the same platforms at the same time, just to be confusing. And then it goes out on in podcast form afterwards, if you look for This Week with David Rovics, wherever you get your podcasts. And we are currently broadcasting right now on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, as well as KABU Community Radio, and my own Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, VK, Twitch, and Twitter accounts. And today, with no further ado, we are spending the hour with a longtime organizer, journalist, and artist from Detroit as well, Dave Sands. And we're just going to bring him onto the screen, having done the intro.
Hey, David. Yes.
Hey, great to see you. Great to have you with us. Yeah, so I never know where to start with these things, but you're in Detroit and you are actually out, getting out and about and seeing what's happening there. And you know, I was just saying before we went on that what I'm seeing here is just a constant crumbling of everything, of society, of people, of the obvious sort of more and more poverty and more longer and longer lines for food handed out at elementary schools, and more and more people moving into their cars, and to say just nothing about all the politics and everything else, but can you give us a picture of what does Detroit look like from your vantage point?
So there's I guess good and bad. COVID, I guess the first place to start, just COVID hit Detroit really hard. We were one of the early epicenters, I think, because there's an airport by here that flies to China, but the African American community in particular was hit very hard. I have a colleague who lost her mother, her grandma, I believe, and another relative, and so the Black community is really, really hard. And a lot of people I interview, if you bring it up, they'll start crying. It's just, there's just a human toll. Belle Isle, which is the big city park in Detroit, they had a big memorial just for the lost people, and people would drive their cars by and try to remember them, because for a long time it was just chaos when this started, and so there was some public mourning. It's been difficult for people. So
the actual virus itself has been actually the one of the big problems, not just the consequences of shutting down everything and not having social services.
Yeah, and it's on the rise again in Michigan right now. But aside from that, the sort of stuff you mentioned. It was just utter confusion at first. And I remember doing some stories about this. There are lines at schools where they were going to give out school lunches to the kids who really need those lunches, for nutrition. There wasn't enough at first. Social services came through to an extent, but people were hungry. People were worried. People were out of work. The unemployment system was, again, utter chaos at first, for people to try and get some sort of relief. Even when there was, that relief bill passed, it was very difficult and very confusing. They were understaffed. There were all these crashes on the unemployment system. So it's been stressful. On the other hand, and I maybe you're seeing this out in Portland where you are too, there's all these online mutual aid networks, which is kind of cool where we're coming from, right? Where like just all these Facebook groups or online groups would form, and people would just start, the neighbors would help, help out neighbors and share resources and share information and help each other out. Maybe babysit their kids if someone had to go to work or something like that, So, that was on one hand, there's sort of an explicit kind of anti-authoritarian awareness about that. But on the other hand, it was just sort of spontaneous. And I sort of remember when 9/11 happened and everyone was like, there was all these people kind of wanted to help out, with the families that were affected by 9/11, giving blood and that kind of thing. And I think sometimes you see these crises, when these crises hit, the people, it does, in a weird way, sometimes bring out the best in people. So that's something to think about too.
The solidarity, the mutual aid, is a lot of the mutual aid going on? Is it a lot of the same people who have been involved with other mutual aid projects over the years? Because Detroit certainly has a lot of history of mutual aid projects.
Oh, some of them for sure. And I'll say this about Detroit too. I think we're known for kind of being a scrappy, kind of resilient place where people help each other out. Because, I mean, if you think about it, you know, since the 70s, Detroit's sort of been in decline. And to a large extent, I think we've just sort of been abandoned by, you know, institutions like governments and financial institutions. There's been a little more like economic investment in the last couple of years, but Detroit's just been through this long era, I'd call it, of just sort of abandonment. And so I think there is sort of a culture of looking out for each other, neighbors looking out for each other, of groups working together. You know, activist groups tend to work together. They don't tend to fight as much in Detroit as I hear in some places, and over silly sectarian stuff. I think just the stakes are so high here. So there's sort of been a coming together, and I think that sort of maybe reflects something of the character of Detroit. So that's been going on. I don't know, how are things in Portland? How would you describe the situation there? You know, maybe you've talked about it before, but I'm kind of curious.
No, sure, absolutely. Well, I mean, I'm just realizing when we talk about Detroit, how much it is such a different situation than Portland in so many ways. Like, I mean, although there's a lot of commonality in terms of the virus, the failed nature of the state, the completely incompetent the employment in system that's just not functioning. Like, we have that's going on here in big time. I've been waiting since April to get any response, me and tens of thousands of other gig workers, just nothing, you know. But then at the same time, it's also a different situation because it's like it's a majority white city. It's getting whiter all the time. It's extremely expensive, getting extremely gentrified. You know, rents doubling and tripling. So many people who can't afford to live anywhere living in their cars. So I mean, so in terms of like in a lot of ways, there's similarities and differences. I know you have lots of slumlords in Detroit, but the cost of actually living, you know, holding down an apartment is, I think, a fraction of what it is here, you know. So yeah, so that, you know, there's a lot of differences and similarities. So it's but Detroit has still less than half the population that it had in the 1950s. Yeah, which is really quite something, you know. That's so decreasing. Different.
Yeah, it's still decreasing too. It's strange. On the other hand, there tends to be, you know, what people are talking about, it's sort of gentrification. There's sort of younger suburbanites, or, you know, more affluent people are moving into the city, but not in any numbers that's going to affect the general decline of the population.
It's good, because maybe I'll end up there, because I mean, every city I move to gets gentrified to hell. And it seems to be, as soon as I get there, that's the time that it's going to get, you know. But maybe Detroit is big enough and messed up enough that it's not going to get gentrified just because of me. So
yeah,
I've already left New York, Boston, San Francisco, and Seattle to end up here.
I would say there's still fears about displacement, but maybe it's not exactly as traditional. Maybe it's not exactly sort of the traditional gentrification that people talk about, but there are definitely people in neighborhoods, certain neighborhoods, that are really worried about being displaced. So that is something that's going on as well.
Right. So that is a phenomenon. Oh, because then there's other neighborhoods where the houses are largely abandoned, and you can't even get a loan to buy a house because the house isn't worth as much as it would cost to fix it up. And that sort of bizarre problem of capitalism. Capitalism is such a strange beast, and it behaves differently in different places. It has different sort of dynamics of destruction.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's very adaptable.
Very adaptable.
We're always, it feels like everyone's always catching up with what's going on, like Uber and all these like new developments where they find ways to skirt around labor laws by using technology. And it's just this constant game of just trying to get back to where you were a minute ago, you know?
Yeah. Tell me about what's been, have you been covering events involving the governor and the militia group that was talking about kidnapping the governor and all these sorts of dynamics? I mean, that's another thing Michigan and Oregon have in common, very polarized, I guess you could say, with a lot of radicals and a lot of fascists as well.
I haven't covered directly. I've covered a little bit about sort of the governor and COVID. It's very frightening, and I don't know. It still kind of makes my head spin. Like, how this stuff got politicized, you know, where it's like really the governor is really taking some, I mean, you can disagree with political leaders, but she seems to be trying to work to kind of preserve the health of people in the state. And it's politicized by Trump and all these people. And yeah, there was a plot to kidnap the governor and I think execute her on video. And she got arrested. There's been all these right wing activity, like a bunch of right wingers showed up maybe in the early part of the pandemic, maybe in May or something. They showed up at the Capitol with guns and they're inside the Capitol with guns. And it's sort of frightening. So, and then there was recently another neo-Nazi group that got kind of, their leaders got rounded up because they're plotting something else. I don't know what it is exactly about Michigan. I think because there's a lot of like radical and progressive kind of activity in Michigan, but there's also just a lot of reaction. The downriver area in particular, I've got a friend who grew up there. He knew like people who were Nazis in, you know, high school and stuff. It was like something that, you know, it was something that they did. You definitely would see them once in a while at the punk rock shows in Detroit growing up. So there is that, maybe it's because people came here from the South, you know, because of the auto industry or something. They brought some of that, but there's just a lot of, there's a lot of racist neo-Nazi activity. And it's really being fueled by leaders like Trump and the GOP who really won't denounce it in any serious, you know, sort of like continued sort of way, you know?
Mm. In fact, they do the opposite of denouncing it.
Yeah, really. they throw fuel on the fire. It's worrisome, you know. I would say, like, so Detroit was one area. There's like anti-racist activists as well. When Spencer came to town in Lansing, they got chased out by like anti-fascists and stuff like that, and he hung up his coat after that. He stopped touring after that. So Michigan's a very polarized place, and so you sort of see both sides of it, you know. But there's just a lot of angry white supremacy kind of activity at the same time. A lot of progressive and radical radical organizing. Black Lives Matter has been pretty big around here. I've seen like marches go right by my house. I've kind of some of the marches, and they've been really big and continue to this day be really big and vibrant and pretty well disciplined, I'd say too. At this point, there's been some scuffles where they were sort of attacked by police, and it sort of was caught on camera of just the cops going after people and beating them, you know, really unprovoked. And so they've gotten very disciplined and they just, you know, and very organized and just doing marches and trying to raise awareness, and they've got some demands. So yeah, the Black Lives Matter has been very, very strong in Detroit. So there's like, again, just both sides of it are coming through. I will say there's been a lot of labor organizing too on that note. You know, the local Wobblies, they got together with a bunch of labor groups and organized sort of a solidarity kind of Black Lives Matter event, which is kind of interesting. Even some of the more mainstream kind of unions kind of got together on that. So that's been happening. There's been a lot of local chapter of the Wobblies has been organizing efforts, and there's been a lot of interest in that right now. I've even heard of like friends of mine where like they would just, during the early days of the pandemic, they would just like have like kind of wildcat strikes where like they wanted PP and they wanted raises, or they just walked off the job and they got it. You know, a friend of mine's a pizza delivery guy did that. And I'll tell you, so during all this, I sort of was watching this Amazon series about the Black Plague, and there's actually a lot of parallels about this. What was her name? I got it written down here.
So it's like a documentary about the bubonic plague. We're talking about the Black Death. It has such colorful names that really evoke how bad it was. When is it? One third of Europe died of the plague.
Yeah, and so this academic Dorsey Armstrong gave this lecture series about it, and there were all these labor uprisings back then as well. There was this Ciampi revolt, which was in Florence, where the wool carters, you know, they were getting heavily taxed, and there was this labor shortage because of the plague.
The workers all dying.
They literally overthrew the city government, like the laborers there, you know.
Right.
And so you see this. I've just seen a lot of parallels. I see like parallels with the QAnon stuff too. You know, like they were like persecuting Jews for all this stuff back then. And then you see QAnon. I don't know if you guys have been following this, but as a Jew, as someone who learned about my history growing up, like there's something called blood libel where they accuse Jews of like killing babies and you know, baking their bones into matzah and drinking their blood. And that's exactly the sort of stuff that QAnon's talking about. So it's, I mean, it's
sort about of, about Jews doing that, or do they talk about Jews? QAnon, is that a
some of them do on the some of them do on the websites. From people I've talked to who go on the websites and looked at them, and that's just. But the underlying theme of QAnon is that these Hollywood elites and you know, this organized satanic cabal is kidnapping children and using their blood to you know, extend their lives and all these weird loony theories. They all come back to sort of classic sort of anti-Semitic tropes. So it's just weird seeing some of the parallels between like the Black Plague and that some of the same sort of like conspiracy stuff's going on. And in some ways, I think we're just living in the age of conspiracy too, where facts don't matter and, you know, just like speculation runs wild and you can get people to do anything based on like these like, you know, fears that leaders are stoking. So
it's really, I, you know, I'm getting this coming at me constantly now because I just wrote a song called Vaccine about how happy I am that there are vaccines being developed. And, you know, which, you know, of course I knew I was going to get all kinds of stuff for that from, you know, the people, the anti-vaccine crowd. But, you know, which is also partly why I wrote the song, because I think it's also, you know, to whatever small influence I have, I want people to know that vaccines were a very good invention, you know. And there are lots of problems with all sorts of pharmaceuticals, and there's lots of bad side effects, and not everything should get approved, et cetera, et cetera. But this is not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, which is what they're... But the thing is, though, that it's in these times... With the algorithms of YouTube and Facebook promoting conflict and promoting confusion, and you know, it, really, no matter how many groups they ban, their algorithms promote this kind of confusion and conspiracy theories just by the way they operate. So they really, you know, as somebody said, the problem with Facebook is Facebook. Basically, it's the whole thing. It's the whole way that they conduct everything, and the same with YouTube with these algorithms. But then at the same time, as that is one of the things I'm often thinking about with regards to all these conspiracy theories around the virus, but also like we went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan on completely false pretenses. Thousands of Americans, you know, millions of Iraqis. I mean, you know, people, so many people died, countries destroyed based on, you know, false pretenses. And that's the case with so much of our, you know, history as a country, with, you know, the media and politicians making up stories that, and, you know, that we're supposed to believe that we don't live in an auction. We, you know, that money doesn't influence politics. I mean, they lie to us every day, you know. And then, of course, when we don't believe, when some people don't believe the virus is real, you know, then that's a real problem. But why, you know, of course, people don't believe what they're saying. They're lying all the time. It's a big problem, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, I read a book by William Gibson a while back called The Parafol, and he was talking about conspiracy theories, and he made a really good, or one of his characters made a really good point. So he said conspiracy theories, they have to be simple, you know, because people are really afraid of how complex and out of control things are, more than they're afraid of whatever the conspiracy is. So I think it gives people a sort of sense of comfort that things are sort of under control. You just have to get these bad guys out of the way, or you just have to do this or that. And I think that's a sense of control. I think also with my personal kind of sense about the virus is just, there's a lot of religion involved in this, where people just, there's a lot of religious people, I think, are the ones who are not wearing the masks, you know, not completely, but sort of.
It's a pattern all over the world, isn't
it? You know, and there's this, you know, there's this whole, their spiritual leaders are telling them they're safe and stuff like that. So I think they believe that because they're virtuous, maybe they're protected. I mean, it's hard to understand. I think there's a lot of, and there's some complex reasons why, and different reasons why people don't wear masks, but I think that's one of them, you know?
I mean, it's definitely an undeniable pattern, it seems. I mean, from the Orthodox Jews in New York and Israel to the church in South Korea to all kinds of religious gatherings and some... Pakistan? I mean, it's across the board. Every religion, it seems, they seem to want to embrace the idea that God is stronger than the virus. And they're being struck down.
I mean, in Detroit, there's definitely a lot of black congregations. I think they're probably wearing masks and being a little more safe, but that's because the population's been sort of devastated here.
Right.
It's definitely, I don't know. There's definitely it's definitely a political kind of thing too. Like where you stand on that political left or right thing, I think is a good predictor too, because of, you know, because of all the misinformation that's purposely just being thrown around.
Yep. Have you done much exploration of the whole QAnon phenomenon? I mean, in terms of the plague, I just want to say that one thing I came across in Howard Fast's History of the Jews a long time ago, which definitely is one of the little bits I particularly remember, was that apparently the whole blood libel thing and around like Jews were poisoning the wells, as they said, which of course wasn't true, but the legend went around Europe that Jews were poisoning the wells, and this is why people were dying of the plague. But the thing was that apparently Jews were not dying of the plague as much as many other people were. And Howard Fast's, according to what he concluded, I can't remember where all the information came from, but the idea being that Jews were more often wearing cloth rather than leather and had different hygienic practices and often lived in, neighborhoods that were exclusively Jewish, and this whole phenomenon, ghettos. Right. And this whole phenomenon altogether was created people who were more resistant to the plague. So then that also made the rumors worse.
Yeah, I mean, but it just also feeds into this long history. I mean, there's a bunch of massacres in Germany, you know, specifically related to this. And it just sort of feeds into this long history and this long narrative and the fact that Jews were, you know, forced to do certain sort of unpopular jobs so they could become scapegoats, you know.
Yeah.
The lending thing happened so that, you know, an unpopular group that would kind of draw the resentment, and then the king could just kill them off if they didn't want to pay their debts and stuff like that. I mean, it's mm-hmm. sad history, but
really
that's how scapegoating works, right?
Yeah.
So it feeds into that. And the QAnon stuff, there's definitely a lot of anti-Semitic. I've talked, unfortunately, a lot of people, you know, are into conspiracies, and I've talked to some people, and they see anti-Semitic stuff on the QAnon sites and stuff like that.
Have you ever had any luck with sort of bringing somebody out of the dark side in terms of these the conspiracy theories? Or I mean, because I don't know. It seems like some people dabble with that realm, and then other people just go way off the deep end, and then sort of don't seem to know where they get their information or what's true and what's real.
I've seen some people come back from the brink, but honestly, I know a lot of movement people got sucked into that stuff with Alex Jones and start following stuff. I don't think they become straight on neo-Nazis, but they get wrapped up in that stuff. There's in Detroit, there's African Americans who get caught up in that stuff. Maybe that's part of why we see some like increase in minority support for Trump and stuff. But yeah, it seems, I think it just has to do with sort of the instability of society right now in particular. This stuff's been kind of growing steadily since the 90s. I remember kind of first kind of experiencing a lot of the stuff. And that kind of, when I first read it, it was kind of funny, right, and weird. But then it's maybe after X-Files and stuff, it started to take on this life of its own. And I think it's just because, you know, everything's crumbling right now. You look at the political leadership, you know, Trump is absolutely insane. Biden, you know, was basically ran on this coalition of I'm not Trump, and he won, and the coronavirus, but there's not any platform, there's not any like theory behind it. It's just neoliberalism sort of trying to reassert itself, you know what I mean? So
yeah,
neoliberalism causes the instability that we're dealing with, the austerity, the fact that all the factories moved out of Detroit and caused all these job losses, that's due to capital, that's due to neoliberal government policies, and creates all this instability. And then there's nothing really, I guess there's this sort of growing progressive movement. I think maybe that they underestimate the power of elites and sort of financial interests to kind of reassert themselves. But there doesn't seem to be a lot... There just doesn't seem to be a lot for people to sort of, well, let me put it this way. When I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, there's sort of more of a commonly accepted narrative about society, and it seems like it's all broken down, and there's just more questions than answers right now, and a lot of anxiety and a lot of fear. We have climate change. We have this COVID virus. We have really an economy that nobody even trusts to, you know, really meet their needs, and everyone's got side hustles in Detroit because they're just, you know, trying to make ends meet. And so there's just more questions than answers right now. And maybe that's what's sort of contributing to the grasping onto these theories, because at least it's something, you know?
Yep. Just, and then that makes a lot of sense. And it's also the same. I mean, there's so many other potential factors, including social media and the way that they, that those platforms operate, but then so many people are suffering so much. And then of course it's the, as you know, I can't stand seeing anybody. I mean, as much, I don't mean to squelch anybody's party or anything, but when I see anybody being happy about Biden's election, I cringe, because the idea that, you should be happy that the delivery system for fascism has been elected rather than fascism itself. I mean, it's better to have the delivery system than the thing itself, but you know, perhaps, but I mean, this is how we got Trump, was through the Democratic Party and neoliberal rule, and the Democratic Party's breaking the whole social contract in the 1970s and stabbing the American working class in the back. And I mean, you know, this is the, I think also this is also a lot of where groups like the Michigan Militia come from, is this kind of element of the formerly employed, you know, because I mean, I think there was some study that found that the most likely Trump voters were people who have lost income over the previous 10 years.
Yeah, I think there's also a divide sort of between like what I said, there's like a sort of mass sort of polarization about education, college education. You know, I read this interesting article on The Intercept by this guy, Murtaza Hussein, who's sort of talking about the appeal of Trump to sort of working class people, and specifically the minorities. And like those people, just the way they talk is really blunt and a little bit vulgar and direct. And I think people I think it feeds into something that Michael Albert called the coordinator class, where like there's a lot of resentment against educated elites and stuff like that. And I think maybe the Democratic Party is sort of like, that's sort of the party for sort of educated sort of elites, managers, doctors, you know, professionals, and maybe there's some class antagonism going on. And maybe just because of the way that Trump comes across, or the guy was also talking about the former mayor of Toronto, Ford, who was also kind of a similar figure, very vulgar, but very direct and very, you know, just confident. And maybe maybe there's just more of an appeal by that kind of way of acting, as opposed to like the Democrats kind of being seen as sort of like this party of, you know, sort of well-off liberals and stuff like that. Now that's not the whole picture. There's this whole coalition of, you know, progressives and younger folks and black people and stuff like that. But I mean, it seems like the people running the Democratic Party and are kind of putting on those affectations. So maybe that's sort of leading to what we're seeing here, this polarization. I mean, it seems like the working class just doesn't have really any place that's going to help them in the political system right now. So it kind of, maybe it's grasping towards straws. It's hard to figure out, but it's distressing, you know what I mean?
Although, in terms of electoral politics, as unlikely as it might have been that the Democrats would ever allow Bernie Sanders to become their presidential candidate, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of reason to believe that the same things that appeal to a lot of people about Trump's promises were actually the same kinds of things that appealed to a lot of people about Sanders, as strange as that seems to a lot of progressives to equate the two of them in any way. You know, actually they're both talking about, you know, jobs for the working class, and both using the term working class in their speeches on a daily basis. They were the only two candidates, I believe, out of all of the different Republican or Democratic candidates running over the past 8 years who used the term working class on a daily basis.
Yeah, I would agree. I think I've read some studies from 2016 saying that like Bernie and Trump had some of the same, they drew on some of the same pool of supporters. Unfortunately, you know, as long as we both sort of understand, the chips are pretty stacked against progressives having any real sway in the Democratic Party. I mean, I don't necessarily see it happening, but I mean, that's sort of our opportunity as organizers, especially people who are, you know, labor organizing or, you know, whatever your cause, climate change or whatever. I do think that Biden being elected, sort of my personal opinion, is there's a little more breathing room and maybe a little more room to kind of push things and push our issues instead of just constantly reacting to these like horrifying things. You know, the last 4 years, I mean, I think a lot of us just had PTSD from it, you know, like locking up immigrants, you know, attacking, you know, LGBT rights, attacking women constantly. So, you know, it's been sort of 4 years of just having to respond to all this insanity, you know, and so maybe there's a little more room to under this environment. Yeah, the core instability is still there, but maybe there's a little more breathing room and a little room to kind of pursue things that organizers need to pursue right now, you know, with causes that are going to help the climate and help working people and build sort of working class power and consciousness, you know. So, I mean, that's my hope. We'll see. But I'm definitely glad that Trump's gone, just because, you know, as a Jew, as someone who's just scared of fascism, the immediacy of it was just frightening to me.
Mm-hmm. And then, although in opposition, that could be, I mean, I don't know, fascists in opposition can be a pretty scary phenomenon as well, I imagine.
Yeah, they're not going away.
No, for sure. Him and his 70 million Twitter followers or whatever.
Yeah, I think he's kind of sort of unlocked Pandora's box there, because, I mean, the worst case scenario really is that, like, these far right militia people, they mingle with sort of the mainstream GOP. I mean, the fact that just so many people are willing to believe that Trump, you know, won, despite just there being absolutely no evidence, is sort of frightening, the power that, you know, I've heard him heard his following sort of described as a cult. They'll like do anything for this guy. They'll kill someone, will kill for him, you know? So it's just frightening. And maybe, and he's going to definitely be there on the sidelines fomenting, you know, discord for his own sort of narcissistic needs. But maybe him just not having that stage there, maybe that'll help at least take the wind out of their sails a little. I don't know. It's, again, just a lot of unpredictability right now. But I'm hoping that, you know, movement people can kind of use this opportunity to just kind of push forward on the stuff that's important to us and not get too sidelined with these electoral things that happen every couple of years and, you know, focus on that for a little bit, right?
I mean, historically, at least in the United States, I think it's pretty easy to make the case that major changes in society that have been attributed to politicians really had much more to do with social movements that made those politicians do those things. And then later, those politicians get identified with these policies, like FDR gets identified with the New Deal, or I mean, it's just only to some extent related to who these people are and if at all, and much more about movements that were pressuring them. To.
Yeah, they get scared into it, really, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look at the Black Lives Matter, unprecedented, just numbers of people, especially, I mean, I'm sure you went to the rallies too, just all the young faces of people you've never seen and the multi sort of racial just rainbow of everything and the energy and the willingness to challenge, you know, ideas about policing, which, you know, I think a lot of people are frightened by it. You know, they think it's just going to have to be the purge if we get rid of them. But I think at the same time, there's just a willingness by, especially a lot of younger people and even older people who are listening, to sort of explore alternatives to this very problematic policing model that's been, you know, sort of, I'm sure you know, came out of slavery and sort of efforts to suppress the labor movement, you know what I mean? And, mm-hmm. And it's really turned into sort of this militaristic force in a lot of areas. I mean, I'm sure both of us know a lot of African Americans who just feel terrorized, you know, on a daily basis, you know, driving around because of just the way that the policing and dealing with public safety, you know, the police response to that has just been, it's problematic. And I'm excited to see a sort of this really willingness and energy to sort of challenge it. And I mean, I'm not sure where it's going to go, but I just really, it's just so, it's such a great feeling to see all these people and just unprecedented numbers just you know, pushing and pushing in new directions, you know?
It's been quite something, and it's been big and very diverse in every possible way. And that's been, you know, really, really quite something. Although it also feels like there's a lot of people who are not represented in this movement clearly. And there's, it's not like a it's not like a broad uprising of the working class. It's a intersectional big movement, but it's not what I'm wanting to see, you know, especially right now. But it's, you know, I mean, it's very exciting, and it's, but it's clearly not representing a whole lot of people who don't feel represented by the movement or feel very threatened by it, and you know, who just voted for Trump. And then, you know, another thing I've been noticing a lot lately, and I don't know what I'm curious if this dynamic is playing out in Detroit, but what's been happening here a lot is my friends who like to smash windows are really thoroughly alienating the more sort of liberal elements, and the protests are shrinking, and the liberals are afraid to go downtown.
No, not at all. In Detroit, there's sort of this long-standing thing where that you don't smash windows. It brings back all these bad memories of just Detroit being abandoned and trashed, and it's just not really something that happens here. No, not at all. Honestly, the Black Lives Matters folks in Detroit are just really disciplined. No, there's, you know, that it's just not happening, and it just doesn't tend to happen in Detroit. Just the African American, just the Detroit community in general just doesn't want to see that. It's not something. It's not seen as striking out against corporations or whatever. It's just seen as trashing Detroit. You know, we have a kind of funny thing every year, or not funny, I should say, but kind of disturbing thing every year when the Tigers have their opening game and a bunch of suburbanites come and like pee all over the place.
And they trash Detroit.
They trash Detroit. And like, it's sort of like, there's this kind of like sense among Detroiters that the people who aren't from the city see Detroit as their dumping ground, you know, or as this playground or this place to disrespect. And so it just has something to do with the culture of the city, where that just really doesn't, it's not linked to activism here. I think it's more of a West Coast thing, but maybe it happens on the East Coast too, but definitely doesn't happen in Detroit. No.
It seems like it would make sense that it would be more of a sort of a thing that would be in the really expensive, glitzy cities, like where the downtown is totally alienating to most people, where all the stores are fancy places that nobody can afford to go into unless you're rich, you know. So this kind of air that a city like place like downtown Manhattan or San Francisco or Seattle or London, or I mean, or Berlin. I mean, there's these neighborhoods that are just so fancy that you feel like you shouldn't even be walking in it, you know. And Detroit doesn't have that, and a lot of most American cities don't have that. But there are some, I don't know, maybe a dozen where there's this kind of extreme concentration of where all the billionaires live, you know, and they exist. They're real people. They live places, you know. They go out to dinner. They drink bottles of wine that cost $14,000, you know, and they don't hang out in Detroit, I don't think.
Maybe some areas you might hang out with the athletic club or something like that, but
yeah, hidden away.
Yeah, there's more of a suburbanization of wealth, I think, in Detroit area.
Right.
Yeah. Honestly, like, you ever see the movie 8 Mile? Yeah, there was like, for years, there was just this thing, wealthy people would not cross 8 Mile. It was
right.
I guess they thought they were going to be eaten alive or something, but they were just absolutely terrified. And it deals, I think, with the racism of the local media covering crime and stuff like that, and just the entrenched racism of the area. But yeah, a lot of wealthy people are just terrified of going to Detroit for many years. I think it's changed to some degree, but there's some areas that people hang out, but I think it's just a very different dynamic here in some ways.
Well, because back in the day when white flight happened and the white return to downtown also happened later in some towns, but not everywhere, right? I mean, there's a lot of towns that did not happen. That sort of like, you know, concentrated flight of wealthy white people back into the centers of cities, like that happened after they all left in the 70s, right? Then they started coming back, you know, in the turn of the century, around this century, and really transformed a lot of places, but not a lot of other places.
Yeah, it's happened to some extent here, but certainly not to the extent as other places. There's definitely like new fancy restaurants, and there's some antagonism, I think, by local folks who realize that some of these new ritzy places aren't for them, you know. And there's been some migration and some fears about displacement, but nothing to the level, I think, of that we see in other cities around the country, or at least not, I mean, non-Rust Belt cities, you know.
And can you talk more about what's been happening with the IWW? It's been growing recently, and been involved with the Wildcat strikes, and what kinds of stuff been happening?
there's organized. I can't really talk about ongoing organizing campaigns, but there people are meeting online and kind of, just again, we've got, you know, it kind of ebbs and flows. It's sort of on the up again. There's some organizing campaigns. There's some efforts to, you know, organize job sites, and people are kind of coming back together. Like I said, there was an, you know, effort to, there's more solidarity unionism here where like,
Are there particular mutual aid projects of note?
Well, yeah. You know, the Wadley Kitchen has for maybe about a decade serves, they do kind of like a sort of just like a soup kitchen kind of thing. And in one of the local parks here, they have this whole community about it. You know, every other Sunday they meet and they have this whole community and homeless just local community members get involved with helping prepare and serve the food. And then there's just a lot of other people. Some of the local unions are involved. So that's sort of a, it's sort of like a, somewhat like a Food Not Bombs kind of type thing that's been going on here. I think it was directly inspired by Food Not Bombs. So that's been going on. That's an ongoing solidarity project. Yeah, there's individual campaigns going on, which I'm not going to talk about. And then there was that sort of union Black Lives Matter sort of solidarity event. And there were and people here, there's more bonds between like maybe just different labor, like more mainstream labor unions and the IWW here. In part because a lot of the people who started the IWW in Detroit in the 90s, you know, they would go out and do solidarity events for walk the pickets for other people. You know, when you have other people's backs, I think they tend to have you. And there's a sort of a spirit of solidarity. And people think of the Wobblies, they think of, wow, these people show up, right? These people show up at our events. These people help us. These people hold fundraisers for sick workers and stuff like that. So there's very strong bonds between, you know, the IBEW and certain different trade unions in the city and the IWW here. It's maybe somewhat unique compared to sort of what I see in other places. It's just more of a, we're all in this together feeling and more organizing and solidarity and working together, even though that there's definitely some campaigns going on our own, but there's a lot of solidarity unionism here. And I guess that's something, maybe it's distinctive about Detroit, at least that I know of. And then there's also sort of mutual aid stuff going on too. So we're here, we're, you know, we're trying to do the work, you know? So that's what's going on there.
One of the campaigns that I think, at least as far as labor in recent decades, that Detroit is especially associated with in some people's minds is the free press and the strike around that. And as somebody who's worked as in sort of, I don't know if I've ever actually been employed as a journalist, but these days that kind of experience is increasingly rare. But I wonder what's it like trying to do journalism from a practical standpoint in Detroit these days. Is anybody actually working as journalists?
it's rough. See, I know some people directly involved with the newspaper strike, and that, you know, really they were willing to spend as much money as they could to break the backs of the newspaper union. And I know people in that struggle to the extent that they would have helicopters, because the newspaper plant was surrounded by strikers. They would have helicopters come and just airlift the newspapers out and stuff like that. So they went to extraordinary lengths to sort of break the unions and the newspaper union anyway. And you know, I believe it exists now, but sort of a shell of its former self. And I'm a freelancer, so I'm just like, you know, I sort of have some steady work, but I'm a gig worker. It's not easy. I'm living sort of paycheck to paycheck, I'm going to be honest. And it's because of the way I think it has to do with the direction the economy's headed, where like they want everything to be a gig economy, and they give you this whole fancy spiel about sort of your own boss, but really it's just so they can get around labor laws. You see it with Airbnb, you see it with Uber, you see it with all these ways that technology is sort of used to make people really really struggle. There's the newspapers themselves. Like, I'm not certain that there's going to be two newspapers very much longer in Detroit. You just like kind of wonder if like one of them is going to fall apart, because as a media worker, the tech industry basically newspapers used to run on ad revenue. Well, you know, Facebook and Google sort of take all that revenue and put it in the tech sector, right? And they still use the news stories, you know, that other people write to you know, sell their service, but they don't, those people who generate the news don't get any you know, they don't get anything to support their organization. So, yeah, it's difficult. I mean, I'm happy with the I work for some sites that, you know, they give me steady work, but it's not an easy living. I'll be honest. I know in Montreal, some of the Wobblies have sort of a freelancers union. It's kind of interesting. They're very well organized. The Montreal branch, they've got, you know, hundreds of people, and they've got a whole sort of like a freelancers union that's not just like newspaper workers, but it's artists and it's everyone. And they, you know, I think they do things so they can share the rates and stuff so that the workers aren't pitted against each other. If you go back to the early days of the IDIWW, in some ways that's sort of how the loggers operated. Like, you know, they people were hired by the job, right? And so so the IWW came in there, and they sort of like organized union halls, and they sort of like organized the sort of, you know, the unemployed or whatever, and sort of the people who were kind of freelance workers. And so I think in Montreal, they're sort of trying to do something. Again, that's a little bit been disrupted by COVID too. It's just thrown a wrench into everything. And I'm sure I'm not alone among freelancers. It's just,
It's such a struggle. It's been,
you're a freelancer, right? Right. I mean, you're a songwriter. I mean, you're not gigging right now. It's just, it's made it really difficult for people who don't have a steady paycheck, you know?
I mean, during the pandemic, that's especially true. But even like prior to the pandemic, I've just been reading, I just finished reading a wonderful book called The Death of the Artist by a guy from around here named Bill DeRizowitz.
Okay.
And what's been so fascinating to me about reading was how I already knew that these sort of corporations like Spotify that sort of intentionally destroyed the music industry in order to basically take all the money, you know, to put it in one sentence, you know, too simply, but that's what was so fascinating about this book is to find out how these same sorts of corporations have done exactly the same things in every different industry, you know, of course, very much including journalism. And he talks a lot about what you mentioned with the ads, which is a huge, huge source of revenue for Google and used to be for newspapers. And now they just, take the money and they decide how much, what little tiny pittance the newspapers might get for the number of hits or clicks or whatever. But as with Spotify, they determine these rates, and these rates can change overnight and become 1/10 of what they were the day before. And, you know, you could have thousands of people's lives ruined by them making some random little, algorithm adjustment, you know. That's what's it's very much systematic.
It's deliberate. Yep. They're aware of it. I mean, here's the thing, they're clash conscious, you know, the people who are doing this kind of stuff, the people with money, the people in the tech industry are making the decisions about, they know what they're doing. And so the challenge is for us to be kind of aware of, you know, ourselves, to organize together, to work together, to sort of develop relationships and find new ways to respond to this together, because what's happened is everyone's been, I mean, part of this is just like this hyper individualism, not in a good way, but in the sense everyone's become much, much more isolated by technology. And that makes, you know, by technology, by the way the workforce has become reorganized, by automation and the fact there's no jobs, everyone's become much more isolated. And so we really have to, I think, respond and sort of come back together. I know we have this in the movement, there's like a really strong emphasis on individualism, but I think, you know, as someone who thinks about this stuff, I think that we need to kind of just, rather than just independence, I think the movement has to think about interdependence, you know, about interconnection, about how we can balance sort of our individual, because that's important to who we are, of having our own individual say, but also think about the community needs, about solidarity and how we work together and kind of balance the individual with the needs of everybody, with the working class. So I think that's our challenge. And I think we need to start thinking that way, you know?
In terms of what may be a niche subject, but I think increasingly not so much for a lot of people, the whole question of gig workers and these platforms that dominate our lives that we are having to sort of interface with, whether we like it or not, if we want to have an audience, you know, whatever we're doing. You know what I'm saying, right? I mean, if you write an article in the press and you want to share it and get it out there and you want people to read it, if you don't share it on Facebook, you'll have as many people reading it as you would if you, you know, in all likelihood, if you shared it on your Facebook page. That's where people are. That's where, but it's sort of like this this problem of you build the highway. Of course, people are going to use it, and you keep paving it every year, and you maintain it really well, and then of course people are going to use it, especially when the alternative is this, like, you know, little path that has lots of potholes in it, and you can't go very fast, and you know, it's just it's sort of a problem of they've become our infrastructure for everything. And then there's also this lottery aspect to it, where you might write something or record something or sing something or whatever in whatever medium it is that goes viral. And there's always the possibility you'll get on that Spotify playlist, or you'll get on the top list on Amazon's picks for the day or whatever it is, you know, and that could even be a life changing experience for people, and probably is on a regular basis, but just not for 99.99% of, you know, good content producers out there. And I wonder, what do you have any particular thoughts on how to organize against these corporations? I mean, a lot of people talk about forming alternate platforms, but I don't think that's the solution personally, because people are, as long as these platforms are dominant and they're out there and they're being constantly invested in, the people are going to use them.
I don't have any good answers for that. I know Michael Albert over at Z Magazine tried to sort of do a left-wing kind of Facebook, and there just wasn't that interest or financial backing. I think they even just did the coding for it and there just wasn't there. You know, no. I know the right's doing this Parler thing because they're getting censored for, you know, Holocaust denial and encouraging people to shoot up pizza stores and stuff like that. But I'm not certain. We kind of made this devil's deal with the internet where, like, we didn't want to pay for it. So the idea was they were going to monetize our information and stuff like that. And they really, you know, you remember at the start it was like indie media and it was very liberatory and like it got really commodified and, you know, I don't think I have the answer on that one. I'm just going to be honest. It's a troubling situation. I support local artists. I'll say that much. You know, yeah. I see a lot of people doing Patreons and stuff, you know,
yeah.
And I know even some local journalists do that kind of stuff. Maybe support local artists is one way to do it. It's not a fix all, but I mean, it's again, we're not in a utopia. We're like dealing with, like, you know, week to week, month to month issues, and we got to survive. So, you know, maybe we need the artist equivalent of rent parties or something like that, but we can't even meet together in person anymore. So it's hard. You know, I used to a bunch of folks run a alternative sort of quarterly called Critical Moment in Detroit. It was sort of a alternative underground paper. And we would have, you know, like 100, 200 people at these parties and stuff like that. And didn't ever seem there was any lack of support when we did that, but, you know, there was a lack of interest in the print medium and we couldn't keep people, younger people interested in sort of keeping the project going. So it kind of folded up, but it wasn't. So I think there's a lack of, I think there is some, at least on the local scene of among people who are involved with stuff, I think there's interest in supporting that, but we have to find ways to connect, you know, the people who want to help out and, again, is that sustainable for a full-time income to support journalists? I'm not sure it is. But in terms of having a media, you know, that talks about, back before the development of the mainstream media, they just had political papers, you know what I mean? You know, and they would just have the people with different political factions would just fund, you know, political kind of oriented papers. And then maybe at the turn of 19th century or whatever, media as an institution sort of had this whole thought of objectivity and, you know, that kind of stuff. And it became more based subscriber based and more, you know, with the Hearst and that kind of stuff. So there are precedents of, you know, and honestly, you look at the underground paper, you know, the Italian anarchists, the different Jewish anarchists, they, you know, they all had they had all their papers and the movement supported them, like back in the day. Now they were sort of more propaganda papers, but you know, there's other models, I guess, out there, but
but they didn't have Google back then. Unhook
themselves from Facebook or Twitter, I don't think it is like necessarily. I don't think it's an all or nothing kind of thing. I think we need to slowly kind of develop these alternative things, and they're gonna have a life of their own, you know. And as a professional sort of journalist, I don't know though. Is that model gonna work to support me to do the work I do right now? I'm not sure, but I think in terms of having a press that talks about things that people care about, that's possible. But you know, everything reinvents itself, and you just have to adapt, right? You know, I started out working, you know, at the Michigan Citizen, which was sort of this Black-owned progressive paper 20 years ago. It's no longer around, and now I'm, you know, basically a full-time internet, you know, journalist. And so the media, the industry completely changed, and I had to adapt. And we're just going to have to be resourceful and, I guess, look around and see what's working for other people, maybe, is the way to do it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
What are the tactics that are working for other people? And then we kind of really support it, you know, and put our money and our energy into supporting that stuff. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on it as an artist who's, you know, dealing it from a more musical standpoint? Because you guys are sort of the same boat as journalists. Like,
yeah, it's really very hard.
It's really hard to be a full-time musician from what I heard from my musician friends. You know, it's like something, it's more likely you're going to have a side gig, you know?
Yeah, it's the same kind of situation, really. I mean, you know, where it used to be, you'd sell lots of merch and oftentimes get paid to play gigs. And, you know, I mean, these things are both of those phenomena are much less. I mean, you don't sell merch anymore. And so, yeah, people are turning towards crowdfunding and patronage, you know, if they can, as the alternative to actually making a living through gigs that no longer pay well enough to cover. Of course, you're also talking about rents and cost of healthcare and housing, you know, doubling, tripling. So that's another aspect of the whole thing. Yeah, but it seems like at least if we had a few hundred people willing to get arrested in Los Angeles, New York, and Stockholm, we could get Spotify's attention. and I think, you know, I think we need to shut down their headquarters in all three cities at the same time for civil disobedience. We need hundreds of people in each of those cities getting arrested, and we need to do that every day. And then I think we could really quickly get their attention, and then we could get a lot of media attention as well. But all the idea of begging for them to give us a bigger percentage and begging governments like ours that are bought and sold by corporations to think differently about the, you know, the situation, it doesn't seem to be working. But I think civil disobedience could maybe work. You know, who knows? Hasn't been tried yet anyway. you got any predictions for what's going to happen in the U.S. in the next few weeks? Last question.
I think, yeah. I mean, here's the thing with Trump. He's dangerous because, you know, he's unwell and he doesn't have the sort of any sense of shame or whatever, but he's alienated a lot of people. It seems like all his ducks are sailing in terms of the legal election thing. And it's worrisome to see, you know, that he's like fired the head of the Defense Department, you know, the Secretary of Defense, who was standing up against him when he tried to, like, you know, bring in the military to break up Black Lives Matter's protests. It's kind of scary that he's making all these cuts, but he just doesn't have a lot of friends. From what I've read, the senior sort of leadership of the military doesn't particularly like Mr. Trump. So, you know, the officers don't seem to like him. So I'm hoping there's not a coup, you know, or I guess there's this more specific term when someone doesn't want to leave power. But it seems like he's just doesn't have a lot of friends left, and that the lawyers are kind of withdrawing. And I'm hoping that, like, he just kind of, you know, kind of sits in the corner and throws a tantrum, but doesn't, you know, do anything dangerous in terms of trying to get the military involved. I'm sort of, I don't know. My sense of things is that things are cooling down a little bit, but I'm also aware that just a lot of people who are progressives or radicals or people on the left are sort of standing by. And, you know, for coup attempts, large scale civil disobedience, you know, there's definitely a track record of it being able to kind of stop coup attempts. So if he does try that, I think there's a lot of people who are willing to, you know, stand up and stop the system. I think even the leader of the AFL-CIO said they were going to call a general strike. I think I saw a news article about that. So I'm thinking it's going to be a contentious period. I'm thinking that tempers are going to flare a little, but I'm hoping these are going to cool down and we're going to have a transition, and then we're going to have a whole new set of problems, and we're going to deal with it, because there's always a new set of problems, right? I don't know. Trying to be hopeful here.
It's good. Although with the AFL-CIO stopping the coup, I would just quote what another guest mentioned a couple weeks ago, that as far as he's concerned, probably about half their members voted for Trump. So whether they're going to support
enough.
It. Yeah. But it was great talking to you, Dave. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the show.
All right. My pleasure, Dave. Have a great day, and I hope things are get better over there in Portland. Keep on the fight. Keep on fighting, my friend.
You too. Hope to see you on the other side of the pandemic in Detroit, perhaps.
Cool.
Take care.
Yeah.
And thanks so much, everybody, for joining in on this discussion with Dave Sands, journalist, artist, and organizer in Detroit, Michigan. And I'll be back to talk with who am I talking to tomorrow? A wonderful fiction author, John Frankel. I'm just going by memory now, but I should have these things open on the screen. But yeah, I'll be talking tomorrow with John Frankel and discussions with David at the same time in place as this, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KBOO Community Radio and various other platforms. And it's all archived if you look for This Week with David Rovics wherever you get your podcast. And I'll see you again soon. Remember, don't pay the rent. Mutual aid will get us through. Trust your neighbors. I'll be doing a concert, too, on these platforms the last Saturday of the month, every last Saturday, 1 p.m. Pacific. All right. Hope to see you guys again soon. And thanks for listening. Take care. Bye-bye for now.